So these four circuits make up the basis of what we would think of as normal human life.
Yeah, in the Gurdjieff system, the first circuit is called the movement center, the second circuit is the false emotional center, the third circuit is the false rational center, and the fourth circuit is the false personality. Together they make up what Jung calls the persona, or the self we present to society. Behind that is always the shadow, which is the imprints, conditioning, genetic programs, etc., which are not socially acceptable.
The parts that we're hiding from ourselves and others.
Yeah.
Now, you've emphasized that these imprints that are so important on our lives are, in some sense, out of our control. It's just whatever, either through fate or accident, happens to us during our imprint vulnerability permanently shapes our consciousness. Or maybe not so permanently, because according to Leary's ideas here, these imprints can be changed.
Yes, that's Leary's major psychiatric, psychological heresy. Leary believed LSD could change imprints. And one of his first major experiments was to take a group of convicts in the Massachusetts prison system who were due for release, take them on mystical trips with classical music, readings from the Hindu and Buddhist scriptures and LSD, and reprogram them into a state of mind where they didn't feel like criminals anymore. A lot of them cried. They wanted to lead happier and less destructive lives. And there was a follow-up study a year after they were released. A year after release, something like 85% of all criminals are back in jail for a new crime. In Leary's case, something like 80% of them were still leading productive and non-criminal lives. Another associate in that did a follow-up study in the 70s, and all the ones he could find were still out on the streets, not back in prison. Leary had reversed the recidivism rate. There should have been a lot more research on that, and we wouldn't be building so goddamn many prisons now, would we? But again, the government shut down the research. They wanted to keep mind manipulation a secret that the CIA could use for their own purposes and nobody else would know anything about.
So the implication is he had somehow re-imprinted them to be nicer.
He re-imprinted them to see that their life script, their basic programs on the first four circuits, were leading them to a life that would remain basically unhappy. If you go on committing crimes, you're going to spend most of your life in prison, which is not a nice place to spend most of your life. You're also going to spend your time outside looking over your shoulder all the time to see if the cops are coming yet. It's not a happy lifestyle. Leary's psychology is based entirely on the principles of hedonic philosophy. What do you want out of life? To have a good time. Okay, get rid of all the programs that make you miserable. And if one of your programs is holding up liquor stores, you're going to have to get rid of that one because that gets you in prison pretty frequently.
So have other people been able to reproduce his findings?
Only to a limited extent because once the good reports were coming in, not only from Leary, but from at least 100 other investigative teams were reporting great results with LSD, the government shut down all the research. All the research that has been done since then has been illegal and therefore not published. But there is research going on. It's like the Inquisition, as I said. There are people, scientists, doing research and communicating with one another, but they just don't publish, so they don't bring the government down on their heads.
So Leary had found that you could re-imprint through using psychedelic drugs. Have people found other ways to re-imprint people?
Well, Stanislaus Grof, whose work I haven't studied closely enough to have an informed opinion, he believes that through breathing exercises and loud music he can produce re-imprinting experiences. He doesn't use the word re-imprinting, but what does he call it? Spiritual transformation. But what he means is the same as what Leary means by re-imprinting. Stanislaus Grof prefers more religious terminology. Leary prefers more ethological terminology. It's a difference in style.
And are there other techniques?
Well, if you take classic yoga, like Patanjali taught, his system is you start with asana, which is holding one posture as long as you can and doing it every day for longer and longer periods. Eventually, you get over the fidgets, the boredom, and all the general nuisance of it, and you find yourself in a very peaceful place. This seems to be the unimprinted first circuit, before you've imprinted either infophobia or infophilia. The next step is pranayama, which quiets all the emotional compulsions on the emotional territorial circuit. And the third step is dharana, which is concentrating on one image and driving all words out of your head. That seems to be the hardest step for most people. So very few people follow that. Instead of dharana, there's mantra. Instead of trying to concentrate on a red triangle, which tends to turn orange after a while or go off screen entirely, you take a phrase and just keep repeating it. I learned one from some wandering shaman I met once. Shamadi Shawadi, Shamadi Shawadi, Shamadi 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 Shawadi, Shamadi Shawadi, Shamadi Shawadi, Shamadi 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 Shawadi. It's almost like a windshield wiper. It really cleans the mind. It closes down the third circuit. So you've closed down the first circuit with asana, the second circuit with pranayama, and the third circuit with dharana or mantra. And then you close down the fourth circuit by taking a vow of celibacy. And then you got a body full of energy and nowhere to go, so you explode upward into one of the higher circuits. At least that's my analysis of how yoga operates. Those who don't want to take a vow of celibacy can study the art of tantra, which takes the sexual energy and instead of blocking it entirely, formalizes and ritualizes it into a higher circuit experience.
Now that we've looked at the four basic circuits, what are the higher four circuits?
Well, the fifth circuit Leary calls the neurosomatic circuit, and I've never found a better label for it. The neurosomatic circuit is turned on by bleaching out the first four circuits in traditional yogic way, or by just ordinary meditation without yoga exercises and all the accessories. Just spend 45 minutes a day trying to clear your head of all thoughts by repeating a mantra or by concentrating on some object in your field of vision and blocking everything else out. Koszybski recommended staring at an apple. Koszybski, the inventor of general semantics. Anyway, the most fashionable method recently is the brain tuning machines. You tune the machine down from beta to alpha, and you get very tranquil and calm for a while. You turn it down below alpha to theta, and you get into a pretty deep meditative state. Anyway, the fifth circuit, the usual way of turning it on, which I almost forgot to mention, throughout most of history has been cannabis. Cannabis is the specific chemical for the receptor sites in the brain where the neurosomatic circuit is activated. Whether you smoke it or eat it in muffins or brownies, it tends to create an explosive enrichment of the sensory-sensual manifold. And immediately you'll find a hell of a lot is going on in your body and in your perceptual field that you never noticed before. And a lot of it is hilarious, and a lot of it is sexy, and a lot of it is thrilling, and a lot of it just bowls you over with mystical awe.
How does turning on this fifth neurosomatic circuit affect the other four circuits?
Well, first circuit anxieties begin to look silly and paranoid. Second circuit emotional compulsions begin to look a bit robotic and you're embarrassed by them and you want to get rid of them. And third circuit reality tunnels begin to seem very subjective and relative and none of them look objective and totally real anymore. And your fourth circuit sexual pattern begins to seem a bit robotic and silly too.
So you gain quite a bit of perspective on yourself.
Yeah, you're gaining more freedom.
Bob, does standard psychology recognize this neurosomatic circuit?
Well, it's one aspect of what Freud called the oceanic experience. Freud recognized it as a human phenomenon, and he thought it was a blissful regression to infancy, which he thought was harmless, but you didn't want to stay there. You had to come back to adult reality eventually. But he did recognize it as a human experience. Jung puts all the higher circuits under the general title intuition, bunches them all together. There's a guy named Kenneth Ring who did a lot of LSD research when it was legal and then switched to near-death experiences when he couldn't use acid anymore. He started collecting experiences from people who had out-of-body experiences or seeming out-of-body experiences or whatever you want to call them. He found a lot of similarities to LSD trips. And he has his own label for the neurosomatic circuit, but I forget what it is. But there are several different names for it. And then in Hinduism, it's called dhyana, the trance of unity, because it tends to make perception more global and less egotistic.
So is it one of the effects of an opening in this neurosomatic circuit to increase compassion?
I think absolutely. Very strange. I don't think Leary ever talks about that aspect of it. But my experience and the conversations I've had with other researchers, other outlaws, other alchemists, etc., I think the beginning of neurosomatic experience is almost always correlated with it, more sensitivity to other people's sufferings. And I think the correlation or connection between pot and anti-war protest in the 60s was no accident. Potheads were much more horrified by the Vietnam War than alcoholics were. So kids are being burned up with napalm. Gee, that's terrible. Let's have another drink. You can't say that on pot. Kids are being burned up by napalm. For Christ's sake, we've got to find some way to stop that. You feel more. I mean, you're more open. Your senses are open on all levels. The whole organism is much more open. So I think it definitely increases compassion and empathy.
So what day of the week it correlates with the fifth circuit?
Friday, which is named after Freya, the Norwegian sex goddess, the Marilyn Monroe of the Norwegian pantheon. And of course, in the Latin tongue, the day is named after Venus, who's the South European equivalent to Freya, the goddess of sexual ecstasy.
Bob, you made the point that the first four circuits basically are imprinted once and then stay that way for the lifetime unless they're re-imprinted under special conditions. Is that also the case with the fifth neurosomatic circuit?
I don't think so. I think the higher you go on the circuits, the more re-imprinting you can do. I think you can re-imprint the neurosomatic circuit in a variety of ways, depending on what you want to do. If you want to do it, I mean, if you want to concentrate on painting, if you've never been very sensitive to painting, without doing a lot of complicated yoga, just smoke a joint and go into the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, and you suddenly discover what art's all about. Or any other artist you care to pick. I mean, you can reprogram yourself for greater visual sensitivity. And of course, the most famous, the thing that made pot so popular even before the 60s was jazz music, because all the jazz musicians were smoking pot, and so their fans picked the habit up from their favorite musicians. So the first reports I ever heard about pot were, you hear music better. Well, if you keep training yourself, you hear music better and better.
So where do we go on Saturday?
Saturn's day, that correlates with Jung's concept of the collective unconscious, or the true emotional center, according to Gurdjieff. This is accessed through very advanced yogas or years of practice of yoga, or through peyote or psilocybin, or light doses of LSD, or through some of Stanislaus Grof's breathing and music exercises, or through Kabbalistic magic. You can begin to encounter what seem to be separate intelligences. They may be aspects of your own brain. Israel Rigotti says there are two ways of regarding them, the objective way, which is they exist apart from you, or the subjective way, they're aspects of yourself that have taken on numinous qualities and got projected outwards. And then the question is, how do you interpret this, objectively or subjectively? After a couple of decades, I've come around to Israel Rigotti's opinion, which is that it's best not to try to answer that question. Whatever answer you come up with, your next experience will contradict it. I find it very useful to think in terms of Jung's idea of the collective unconscious. What does Jung mean by the collective unconscious? It's got to be inside me if I can contact it at all, but it's inside everybody else too, right? So it's inside and outside at the same time. And that also applies to Sheldrake's theory of the morphogenetic field, which, for instance, one of the things that suggested the morphogenetic field to Sheldrake was experiments by McDougall at Harvard, where smart rats were bred with smart rats and stupid rats were bred with stupid rats, and they were tested over generations at maze solving. And as genetics would predict, the smart rats bred with smart rats got better and better at solving the mazes. the dumb rats bred with dumb rats didn't get worse and worse. They got better and better, too. McDougall found this so astonishing that he repeated the experiment more than once. He did several. And it's been repeated in Australia and Scotland and various other places, and the rats are learning faster and faster. This can only be explained in terms of something that's inside every rat and it's outside every rat in the sense that it's in every other rat, too. And that's sort of the way the collective unconscious, the morphogenetic field, or the neurogenetic circuit function.
Bob, what is the essence of this sixth circuit?
The experience of transcending time. Saturn was the god of time. The experience of feeling that this body right here and now is only a cross-section of a process that has been going on for 4 billion years approximately on this section of space-time and may be related to similar processes going on elsewhere in space-time, possibly. It's a sense of immortality in a sense that when this body dies, the genetic vector of which this body is an expression will just continue through time. And that the rules and laws governing that level cannot be yet, maybe never will be put into really scientific terms, even as we decode the genome. The only way to really begin to understand it is by direct experience of the archetypes, whatever the hell they are and wherever they come from.
Does this give us an even higher level of freedom than the fifth circuit?
Well, if it correlates with Gary Jeff the way I'm trying to make it correlate, yeah, we have even higher freedom there. And a worse sense of responsibility. It's like the Buddha's doctrine of karma. My God, everything I do is going to have effects for the rest of eternity. If you really believe that, and it's hard to doubt it in the light of most of the data of modern science, nothing stops, everything just transforms. So if I do an evil deed, the effects of that are going to go on forever. The only place it stops being evil is when it reaches somebody who's trained in the Buddhist, yogic, or psychedelic, or some type of system where they know how to transform energy, and they say, gee, I just got a lot of bad energy. I'm not going to pass that on. I'll turn it into good energy before I pass it on. That's known as the great work in alchemy, and it's the goal of Buddhism and Taoism and most of the Oriental religions.
So if the neurosomatic circuit helps to increase our compassion, the neurogenetic circuit increases our loving kindness.
And hilaritas. That's a word I picked up from Ezra Pound's Cantos. He quotes Gemisto Plathon, a virtually forgotten Byzantine philosopher of the 14th or 15th century, I forget which, that you can recognize gods, even if they appear in human form, by their outstanding hilaritas, which is related to the English word hilarity and hilarious. But in classic late Greek of Plathon's time, it meant basically cheerfulness, good humor, as we would say, but not in the sense of always joking. And in the Pound's Cantos, the dominant forces are towards the end of the poem that take over and appear in all sorts of forms are amor and hilaritas, love and cheerfulness. I think I've become a much more cheerful person over the years in spite of a lot of tragedies, which, I, you know, everybody has tragedies. I think I've become a much more cheerful person because as you tune on to the higher circuits, you get more and more distance from second circuit emotional, egotistic problems and more sense of the unity and harmony of everything that's going on and your total unimportance in the major picture, really. No, you're not totally unimportant, but you're much less important than you think you are.
So it's the big perspective of the sixth circuit that increases the good humor?
Well, it's the sense that, I've seen this show before. What are they bringing this out of the mothballs and rerunning it again?
Is there a kind of harmonic relationship between these two sets of four circuits? Is circuit five a kind of higher version of circuit one?
Yeah, and in a sense, circuit six is a higher version of circuit two, etc. Yeah. You might say the second four circuits are the first four circuits with more flexibility built into each one of them, more multiple choice. Oh, Leary liked to use the metaphor of the television set. The first four circuits mean that you got four programs you got to look at every day, all day long. The second four circuits means you discover you got an infinite number of channels and you can turn the channels any way you want and pick up any signals you want. You don't have to keep repeating the same four shows over and over.
So where do we go with the seventh circuit?
Well, here's where I departed from Leary's system entirely and brought in some John Lilly. In my books, I call it the metaprogramming circuit. This is the circuit where you begin to reach the level of dialing and redialing your circuits to the extent that you become sort of like a computer that can program itself. To talk about this at all seems totally unbelievable to people who have been heavily imprinted by the fundamentalist materialist reality tunnel. But Christian Science, faith healing in general, and things like that are examples of how people's neurological programs can absolutely overrule things that would be deadly to people without that flexibility. Every type of genius, I think, results from metaprogramming. Beethoven broke through to dimensions of music that nobody even knew existed before him. You can metaprogram yourself into all sorts of places.
So how does it work, or what is the experience like of the seventh circuit?
Well, let's put it this way. Two guys are hit by cars and they're dragged into the hospital. One is a normal four-circuit human being, typical of this level of structure. What's going to happen to him depends entirely on the skill of the doctors and the degree of the injury. The other guy, let's make it a woman, she has a seventh-circuit personality. She knows a lot of it depends on her, so no matter what the hell the doctors tell her, she keeps telling them, I'm going to get better, I'm not going to die, you're all wrong. And she does get better and surprises them. This happens so often that there are two books about it on spontaneous remission, and they're both out of print. Doctors really don't want to think about it. It throws their whole science into doubt. I mean, this is without Christian Science. There are a lot of people who do it just on their own. Like Norman Thomas, founder of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, he had tuberculosis as a child. And he discovered in the tuberculosis sanitarium that the optimists were getting out every day. More of them were being released and the pessimists were still lying there and suffering. So he consciously made himself an optimist, got rid of the TB and got released. And about, forty years later, when he was middle-aged and a very successful editor, publisher, political activist, and so on, he got a very rare African disease, which is considered 100% fatal. Everybody who's ever gotten it, except him, except Norman Cousins, has died. When they told him that in the hospital, he got the hell out of the hospital, the first move towards cure, checked into a hotel, and rented videos of the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers, and had a doctor who was as much of a heretic as himself come in every day and give him a massive shot of vitamin C. And he recovered, and he didn't die. He's the only one ever recorded to have that disease without dying of it. Now, there are some conservatives in the medical profession who say he never had the disease in the first place. That's the favorite way of evading the data. But the plain fact of the matter is that his experience and the way he wrote about it and the evidence he collected from other cases was so impressive that at the end of his life he was teaching at UCLA Medical School, even though he wasn't a doctor. He was teaching doctors how to activate this self-healing process in their patients by encouraging them to be optimist instead of pessimist. He also referred to it as activating the fighting spirit. And it happens all the time, but doctors don't like to think about it because it seems too spooky. And that's only one aspect of metaprogramming. As I said, you can program yourself into a Nazi reality tunnel if you really want to go crazy, but you can program yourself into a Buddhist reality tunnel, a nudist reality tunnel. You can program yourself into a vegetarian reality tunnel. I did for 1 year. I got to the point where I couldn't pass the butcher part of the supermarket without feeling disgusted. It seemed so horrible, all that meat hanging there. Then I got tired being a vegetarian, and now seeing meat in a butcher shop doesn't shock me or revolt me at all anymore.
So who is the person that is doing all this metaprogramming? What part of you stays outside?
Who is the metaprogrammer? That is the question, to which there are different answers. According to Colin Wilson, it's the transcendental ego as contrasted with the ordinary ego. The higher you get in the circuits, the harder it is to talk about them in subject-predicate sentences with the is of identity in the middle of them. They can be better described in art and music, but I do the best I can.
So in the seventh circuit, which relates us to the sun, is that correct? Or Sunday, we have the ability to do constant conscious re-imprinting of all the other circuits.
I suppose so, at the ultimate. I don't know how many people have achieved it to the extent of what seems theoretically possible. But I have seen people achieve really astonishing things, like Timothy Leary when he was dying of cancer. He was still the funniest guy I ever knew. And I think anybody who thinks we're trapped by circumstance, all they need is to talk to people who visited Leary in his last year while he was wasting away and dying a little bit more every day and having pretty continuous pain. Well, of course, he used all the drugs he could find, legal or illegal, to handle the pain, but that's because he was a rebel all his life. But it wasn't just the drugs, it was the long experience he had at re-imprinting and metaprogramming.
So he knew how to metaprogram himself into a state where the...
Where pain and death were just experiences that he could stand above and look down at and laugh about. He especially laughed at the people who felt sorry for him, or the people who thought he was suffering abominably. He was suffering abominably, but he refused to let that interfere with his mind's activity. He had hilaritas to an extreme extent.
Bob, in what sense does the Seventh Circuit relate to the seventh day or Sunday?
Well, that's the circuit where metaprogramming allows you to escape from so many ordinary reality tunnels that the chief symbol for it is the white light of the void in Buddhism, or the empty circle in Zen Buddhism, or the pyramid in the Western occult tradition with the eye on top. Senzaki Roshi used to talk about big mind and little mind. All the previous circuits are little mind. The seventh circuit is big mind. It's you, and yet it's much more than you. And that's why so many people call it the direct communication with God, or becoming one with God, or becoming one with the universe. But you can become one with an ant. You can become one with a crow, as in the Don Juan books.
And so how is this related to the sun?
Well, the sun is the standard symbol of light, liberty, liberation, illumination, God consciousness, God intoxication, self-intoxication to some extent. And the Sufis feel that if you get too far into that without balancing it, you become what they call a mere ecstatic, which in California slang has become a bliss ninny. And we've got quite a few bliss ninnies wandering around these days. It depends on how much you keep your perspective and how much you just enjoy feeling like God.
So there is no eighth day of the week, obviously.
Yeah, and in the Hindu system, the eighth chakra is not in the body, but above the body. Yeah, I call that the non-local quantum circuit. Leary kept changing his name for it. I forget why. I think his last book he called it the non-local atomic circuit or something like that. He was getting closer to my label. We were influencing each other for several years there. I call it the non-local quantum circuit because one of the most fascinating things in quantum mechanics is Bell's theorem, which has been confirmed 5 times now. It's not only mathematically sound, but experimentally it's been verified. And what Bell's theorem says basically is that everything in the universe is in harmony with everything else in the universe. Well, more specifically, it says any two particles once in contact continue to remain correlated in mathematically precise ways, no matter how far apart from each other they move. Even if they're so far apart that information from one can't get to the other in the time you're taking your measurements. So how does information get around faster than light if the things are that far apart? Well, nobody knows, but David Bohm, for instance, gave three lines of interpretation One is that we're going to have to radically redefine our ideas of both space and time, even more radically than Einstein did. The second is that information somehow travels faster than light, even though energy can't. How can information travel without energy? Well, that's the mystery to be solved, but information is somehow getting around. And the third approach is that it's not traveling around, it's always there. The hardware is local. And this is where I like to quote Jack Sarfatti, a physicist who I don't get along with very well, but he does have some great metaphors. And his metaphor for this mysterious interconnectedness, of which Douglas Adams, remember, said everything is interconnected, but some things are more interconnected than others. Jack Sarfatti's model is, think of the universe as an enormous computer. Then think of our galaxy as a smaller computer within the bigger one, our planet a smaller one within the galaxy, our body is a smaller one, our brain is a smaller one, the cells of the brains are even smaller. You work your way down to the quark level, and you got this mini computers. Below the quark level, presumably, there are even smaller computers. And in all cases, the hardware is localized. The hardware is here, not there, now, not then. I mean, from wherever you are is here and now. So the hardware is always localized, but the software is everywhere at once. It's outside space-time entirely. And this is what comes up in near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, high doses of LSD, almost any dose of ketamine, and profound practice of yoga over a number of years. It's called samadhi, union with everything. And this is where synchronicities come from, and it's why so many people continue to have psychic experiences, even though we are told by authoritative sources that you can't have psychic experiences. They're totally forbidden. They can't happen. And if you claim them, you must be nuts. Still, the majority of people will report at least one psychic experience in their life whenever a poll is taken. Some people have dozens of psychic experiences. And this just comes from the big mind rather than the little mind, the non-local rather than the local level, the software rather than the hardware. Of course, I'm using a lot of modern scientific metaphors for traditional mystical concepts. That's because I find the traditional mystical language just doesn't satisfy my criteria of general semantic accuracy and neuro-linguistic programming of the sane sort. So I have to put it into the best scientific metaphors I can find, because this means that everything I say is potentially refutable. If the government would allow free research, everything I say could be either disproven or made more plausible. Nothing in science is ever proven. That would require an infinite number of experiments. But if you disprove enough theories, the one left standing looks like the only alternative we have until we disprove that one. But nothing is ever proven. That what happens is one model seems more plausible than all the others. But in the more advanced sciences now, we frequently have two or three models. In physics, we got quantum mechanics and general relativity, and they're not convertible one into the other. And within quantum mechanics, we've got eight schools of interpretation as to what the equations mean. And nobody is quite sure what general relativity means.
So in terms of the human organism, you picture these eight circuits. Have humans always had these, or are they evolving circuits?
I don't know. The Sufis refer to the higher circuits as the next step. Sufi literature is full of references to the next step. The idea is that we're all evolving into something different. They don't divide it up into four circuits, although they do have a chakra system which more or less correlates with the eight circuits. At least if you're as ingenious as I am, you can make it correlate. Like I've made it correlate with the Gurdjieff system with a great deal of effort and strain, but it does seem to work. As a matter of fact, there are two Gurdjieff schools that are using my books in their curriculum, so I'm not distorting Gurdjieff too much and making his system isomorphic to Leary's.
But do you personally feel, or at least suspect, that these are evolving over time?
It seems plausible to me. I think that the first circuit sort of recapitulates amoeboid life. The second circuit recapitulates vertebrate evolution. The third circuit recapitulates human evolution. The fourth circuit recapitulates the process of civilization. And then we got the circuits that I'm not recapitulating, but pre-capitulating. I think O'Leary used that word once. It's very good. Pre-capitulating. The neurosomatic circuit is pre-capitulating our experiences when we're living outside of gravity while in free space and space colonies. And the neurogenetic circuit is a forevision of the extreme longevity, if not immortality, that's coming very soon out of all these scientific breakthroughs in genetic engineering. And the metaprogramming circuit pre-capitulates what Heinlein wrote about in his two novelettes, Waldo and Magic Incorporated, which is when parapsychology, in spite of all of its critics, proves its case well enough by teaching everybody how to use these powers instead of just waiting for them to happen accidentally. And everybody becomes their own psychic and their own magician, a self-metaprogrammer, which means a higher intelligence, to say the least of it. And the non-local circuit is preparing us, maybe, for fusion with other intelligences throughout space-time.
So clearly, working with these eight circuits could give us tremendous powers to control our own destiny. Can't people use the same technology to basically harm others?
Yeah. Well, I think the major struggle going on is the struggle between those who want to program everybody else and those of us who would prefer to be self-programmers and, as far as possible, teach others to be self-programmers too. Because self-programmers are more cheerful and happy, and it's nice living in a happy world. I just found a quote from Herbert Spencer, of all people, that sums this up. I've been trying to say it for years. Herbert Spencer said it better than I ever have. He said, nobody can be perfectly happy until everybody is happy. And that seems so transcendentally obvious to me, but most people don't have a clue yet about that. As you turn on higher and higher circuits and become more and more sensitive to what's going on, you more and more want to release people from the misery. Well, I don't want to sound pretentious about this, but, you know, like the Buddha, when he realized what was going on, he devoted the rest of his life to trying to deliver as many people as possible from the traps they were in and teach techniques that would work. When people think of Buddhism, they think it's a religion like Christianity, but they'd understand that it is in a sense, but in another sense, it's much better to think of it as a series of psychological games to release yourself from your compulsions.
Yeah, Buddha never claimed to be a deity of any kind.
There's one ancient Buddhist scripture in which he's asked directly, are you a god? And he says, no. And the next question is, are you a saint? And he says, no. And the next question is, well, what are you? And he says, I am awake.
Do you think people use the knowledge you're talking about of the psychological processes to brainwash people, basically?
Yeah, well, here we go back to conspiracy theory. The revelations about MK Ultra, which were brought out by the Church Committee in the Senate back in the late 70s, opened up a real can of worms, which is how much of that kind of research is still going on, and of what Church discovered, how much was there that he didn't discover. Church lost in the next election after those hearings, and Bob Woodward, in his book Veil, presents some evidence that doesn't prove, but makes a pretty plausible case that the CIA spent a lot of money on something they're not supposed to do, interfering in American elections. They're allowed to interfere in the elections of other countries, but they're not supposed to interfere in our elections. But Woodward seems to think the evidence indicates a high probability that the CIA spent a lot of money to get Church kicked the hell out of the Senate before he did any more hearings into these brainwashing processes they were investigating.
What had he uncovered?
Well, what he uncovered was the CIA had given LSD to lots of people without their knowledge and did various head trips on them, that they had also experimented with electroshock, with brain surgery, and with varieties of things. They did some research with giving people LSD and putting them in an isolation tank with their own heartbeat, magnified as the only sound they could hear, to see if that would break them down to the extent that an entirely new personality could be imprinted upon them in place of their old personality. And there was a whorehouse, a hoe house. I like the Southern pronunciation, a hoe house. There was a hoe house in San Francisco where they were giving LSD to all the customers and watching them through glasses to see how it would change their behavior. They gave LSD to some of their own scientists without their knowledge, and one went out a hotel window in New York, and his family sued the government after the church hearings and collected damages. They were researching marijuana, too. Even while they were telling us it was too dangerous for us, they were giving it to soldiers and sailors without their knowledge and trying various head trips on them. One of the goals was to learn how to extract information from an enemy agent that couldn't be obtained through torture or any other technique, that where they had a mental shield of some sort installed by their own intelligence agency where they just couldn't reveal certain things, how to break through that trapdoor code, so to speak, and get them to spill what they weren't supposed to spill. They did a lot of research on that, but they did a lot of research, too, on how to create more than one personality, just like the Manchurian Candidate, which everybody thought was a fantasy. It was a fantasy to the extent that we don't know that anybody ever succeeded. We don't know. We can only suspect. But the CIA did a lot of research on trying to create people who would be CIA couriers and agents and do jobs for them and never remember doing it. They would have two personalities. When they came back to their ordinary personality, they'd have a vague memory. I went to Paris. I had a good time. Had a wonderful love affair, and they won't remember that they were at the American embassy or the Soviet embassy or something doing spy jobs. They won't remember any of that. Whether they ever succeeded, nobody knows, but they sure were trying very hard, and they had almost infinite funding.
Well, and if the
indefinite funding.
Given the power of re-imprinting that you're describing, it seems likely that they could succeed at it.
There's a book called Operation Mind Control by Walter Boward, who has several cases. I feel that the evidence strongly suggests they succeeded. I don't want to say that it's been proven. All can be said is they were doing a lot of research that, from an ordinary human perspective, looks as despicable as Dr. Mengele's research in Nazi Germany. They are mean bastards, they are.
So the antidote to this, as you were mentioning the other day, would be knowing the principles of re-imprinting already.
Yeah, having experience at re-imprinting, so when they start fucking with your head, you can fuck with their heads back.
How does this eight circuit model tie in with Dr. Leary's ideas about life extension and space migration?
Well, to some extent, he thought the higher circuits were preparing us to deal with life extension and space migration, which he felt were inevitable results of the scientific breakthroughs that were occurring and could be predicted to continue occurring from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and so on into the next decade. He felt it was inevitable that there would be breakthroughs that would lead to cures for all the diseases we know of. Now we've got research on nanotechnology, some of which is aiming at building molecular computers that will run through your body once they're injected with a needle. They run through your body and check every cell, and every cell that's malfunctioning, they'll fix it. That seems to be indefinite life extension or possible immortality. And there's a lot of other areas of life extension research going on, and then there's the overwhelming probability that in the 21st century, a lot of people are going to be moving off the planet Earth. And Leary felt the higher circuits would be much more useful after we achieved longevity and space migration.
So if you're living a very long time in a very open environment, the higher circuits are more natural modes of being.
Not only that, but the lower circuits, which are relatively mechanical, would make for more dangerous blunders and for more boredom. If you're trapped in the same timid position on the biosurvival circuit and the same emotional compulsions on the second circuit forever and the same belief system or BS on the third circuit forever, life gets more and more boring. With the higher circuits, life gets more and more interesting. hilaritas, amor et hilaritas.
This concludes session 3. Our program continues with session 4.